And that way, I think we are setting a very important precedent.
And at the end of the trial, the prosecutor gave you a hug. Do you think you changed some minds during the process of the trial?
Yeah, it was a strange thing because the prosecution, the judge, were all very hardened and thought this guy's a radical, he's an extremist, let's throw him in jail and throw away the key. And the jury didn't get to hear most of the evidence of animal cruelty. The judge and the prosecution did. And I think my sense was both the judge and the prosecution, when we were arguing about what evidence should be allowed, we had to talk about that evidence. And even they, and when they heard about how much a baby goat suffers when they have pneumonia, when they heard about the fact that one of the baby goats was covered of lice and unable to stand, and they were swayed. Because I think the reality is when any of us are confronted with the reality of what happens in some of these industrial slaughterhouses and farms, or even small-scale facilities, even the thought of cutting one animal's throat, killing one animal, is disturbing. And they were swayed. And that's a victory for us, I think.
Wayne Shung, we want to thank you for being with us, animal rights advocate, co-founder of Direct Action Everywhere, just convicted on felony charges of burglary and larceny for removing a sick baby goat from a goat meat farm. Got a suspended sentence of 2 years. Thanks to everyone who tuned in for our 25th anniversary celebration Tuesday night. You can watch the full event at democracynow.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. And going out at you on our two translators in White Sam and Hood River and Philomath Corvallis. And of course on the World Wide Web at KBOO.fm. That is our website, which you can go to and re-listen to this program and almost all our other programs. Except I think the nationally syndicated ones. Anyway, glad to be with you this morning. I've had my regular second Wednesday co-host with us this morning on the phone. I'm here in the studio. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Paul.
I should say your full name, Jacqueline Keeler. Mm. And we're going to be talking about land acknowledgments this morning. My board operator, Ty, we tried to actually pull up, so to play for you, KBOO's land acknowledgement, which airs before Democracy Now. Unfortunately, with the automated system, it is not apparently independently in our system, as these announcements once upon a time were, and maybe will again post-pandemic, if there ever is a post-pandemic. And so we can't play that for you, but most likely most of you listening have heard it. And have heard other land acknowledgments. So, Yeah. You want to just get started on that, or you want me to read the kind of what was the starting point for the discussion that we, you mostly, and I added a couple things to the website?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. You can start with that.
Okay. This is a starting point for discussion from Second Wednesday co-host Jacqueline Keeler, Portland-based Native American writer and activist enrolled in the Navajo Nation and of Yankton, Dakota descent. The reality is that most non-Native Americans can live and die for generations in a place and not know the names of the tribes on whose homelands they live. This is why Native activists have pushed for land acknowledgments. However, is this really not enough? Is it just performative? The power imbalances created by colonization and slavery, which continue through white supremacy and corporate domination, won't change without a fundamental realignment of the underlying power structure. This is why the solution has to be structural. Band-aids are not an adequate fix. The society created through colonization and manifest destiny is fundamentally and structurally antagonistic to indigenous people and their lands and cultures. It has to be to protect U.S. land claims and authority. So maybe just to describe what your take is on the history. I know you're working on a piece on this, which is the main reason why we're talking about it. What's your take on what they are and sort of, I don't know, their development? They really, it seems like they're everywhere now.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, I think there was a piece that came out in The Atlantic again, I guess. I seem to be writing a lot of my pieces for Sierra Magazine as a response to things written in The Atlantic Monthly and by a non-Native writer. And he, he definitely seemed to be annoyed when he hears some. Although he definitely failed to attribute them to the sort of advocacy and sort of agency of Native activists. And certainly, the land acknowledgement is the result of the work of Native activists to try to, it's sort of shocking that people can be born and die and live their entire lives in a place and not even know the names of the people who live there, whose land they're on, right? And so it's, I think it does do something about that, at least you hear their names. And I think you often on the show talk about the tribes of the tier, like the Kaifuya, the Chinook, all these tribes, and a lot of people are not aware of them, even if they they may have heard it in school or see place names, but not really understand exactly how the land they live on now was occupied, was more than occupied, because that name, that often the way Native nations, Native people live on the land is referred to by the colonial occupation as sort of a insubstantial thing. Even the legal term for Native nations, domestic dependent nations, as determined by the U.S. government, references a legal ruling by the Supreme Court that was done in the late 1820s, and it's called the doctrine is called the Doctrine of Discovery, right? And this is the way in which the U.S. initially, or to this day, so legally defines its right to the land, to our land, to all of this land that it occupies, and that basically says that only discovering Christian European nations have title to the land. We've discussed this doctrine quite a bit here on the show, and it's still the active law of land. It was cited as recently as 2005 by the Supreme Court in a decision written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and basically says that that Native people do not have fee simple titles of land. That's a legal title to land that only European discoverers have that, right? And so that the only title that Native Americans have is that of animals, of use and occupancy, right? And so there is a sort of very fuzzy idea that Native people just sort of were here, but their occupancy, you know, really didn't amount to much. Do you mean? And so I think that so land acknowledgements do bring at least the, you know, the awareness of the names of the people who lived there to people's ears. But what I think a lot of people kind of feel is it performative, right? You know, I think in the Atlantic Monthly article, the writer was very annoyed at hearing it at a Microsoft sort of corporate event, right? Fighting all the in the Seattle area, and so I mean.
So what do you mean by performative?
So, is it just a way to sort of, you know, as this writer was saying, you know, is it a way to sort of relieve corporate guilt or to seem like to be progressive or without actually having to do anything substantive about it?
Hmm. Well, let's get, you know, it's interesting. I just want to. I looked up, actually, as I was waiting for the show to begin, I put in, you know, in the Google search, land acknowledgement. I did land acknowledgement Portland. And so I'll just read a few. Portland Parks Foundation, it seems like it's almost become a pro forma, almost an obligatory thing now. Portland Parks Foundation, University of Portland, LJIST, I'm not sure what that is. Port of Portland, Pacific Northwest College of Art, Performance Works Northwest, Oregon Wild, Northwest Outward Bound. That's just the first page. I'm sure it goes on. I mean, I don't know. I'd be interested in how many pages, but that's not important. But so I guess one thing that came to my mind is that these are not all the same. These are, you know, some of them are advocacy, you know, environmental nonprofits. Some of them are, well, you know, we're a radio station, a nonprofit corporation, radio station. But then there's some, you know, Port of Portland. I mean, they're major, important landholders, important players who have real power in this area to do things. And they're often called upon to be involved in major decisions that involve tribal peoples and tribal communities regarding, you know, waste, Superfund sites or possible developments, export terminals, and all these that, you know, the tribes in the Northwest that have, you know, relatively more power on such decisions than a lot of other tribes because of the particularity of their treaties and their history. So I guess my question is, so what is the responsibility of different organizations and institutions beyond doing a land acknowledgement?
Yeah, that is, I think, you know, that's part of the question is in, you know, what does this, obviously, I think that it's good to have that awareness because that awareness does not exist, right? The history of Native people has been sort of erased, partly, you know, just out of, I think some of it is definitely the writing of the history of the United States, of course, was written by the victors and people, but I think there is also a real, it's also been sort of U.S. policy to erase Native people, and in the same way they, you know, legally tried to, you know, erase our rights and land. And I mean, there basically are no other people in the world that do not have fee simple title to their land at all, just indigenous people, you know, and just in a few countries, United States and Canada and countries that are basically a colonial or colonial occupation of other people's homeland, right? And I think that, so when you look at it, you know, at a place, definitely, you know, like you mentioned, the Port of Portland has a lot of power to create change. And it's interesting, I just finished an article for Oregon Business Magazine, and it's looking at the Oregon, I think we discussed sort of the Willamette Falls last time I was on here last month, and we had a great interview with David Dean Lewis, who is a historian, a member of the Grand Ron tribe, and a professor. And you know, it's interesting. I think the article, the angle I took on it, actually looked at the ways in which the group that had the Willamette Falls Trust, which included the city of Oregon City and Metro and the state and I think state and there's another one, I can't remember. But anyway, and the county actually included. They signed MOU in 2014 to work on sort of rehabilitating the falls and creating sort of a river walk by it, raising, you know, tens of millions of dollars, about $50 million for a $60 million project so far. And the one party that was not is party to the MOU was the tribe itself, the tribe that had villages there right on, alongside the falls for thousands of years, or several thousand years, maybe even 10 to 15,000 years, right? And the Grand Ron tribe has, a claim to that. Many of the descendants from those villages are at Grand Ron, and yet they were not invited. And in fact, they did not become party until they actually purchased the Blue Heron Mill there, the abandoned Blue Heron Mill, to the paper mill, to begin to work on rehabilitating the area. And then they basically had to buy a seat for themselves at the table. They were not a partner, right? And so it was only a few years ago that this trust actually started to create sort of an indigenous sort of advisory group. And so it's the ways in which these sorts of meaningful ways these institutions that are all around us ignore Native people, you know. Even when I was reporting back in 2016 on the takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, I remember talking quite a bit to the tribal council, the Burns Paiute tribe, I found out that in all of this, the Governor Kate Brown had never spoken to them when this whole thing was happening, right? And I just happened to be at an event tonight, and actually be seated near the governor. And I took a chance as she was leaving to shake her hand, and I asked her, I said, "Have you spoken to the tribe?" You know, this was while the event was going on, while the takeover was going on. And she said, and she looked very annoyed, and she said, "Yes." And I actually did a FOIA request, and I found what came back was that she had not had any contact with the tribe at all, documented. And then right after I spoke to her like that, then she immediately called the tribe, and the tribal council contacted me, and they were ecstatic that she had contacted them, right? When this major, you know, incident was going on their own homeland, they were not contacted, they were not part, and they had to throw their own press conference and address the issue and to get media sort of attention on their rights to the land, right? And so all the time, business is conducted, and Native nations and tribes are completely forgotten, right, in the matter. And so yeah, there are, so are land acknowledgments enough? And I imagine Metro has a land acknowledgement. And I don't know if the Oregon City does. I'm actually part of the land acknowledgement story I'm working on is that the city of Gladstone, which is located right, you know, on the Clackamas River, it goes into the right near the falls there, near the Willamette. They have a big brouhaha going on over land acknowledgement. in October.
Well, we'll get into that. I got to take a break here for just a second. I'm talking with Jacqueline Keeler, my second Wednesday co-host here on Wednesday Talk Radio. If you're just tuning in. This is a weekly program. We have talk shows here on KBOO Radio every morning, except for Thursday. We'll probably be getting a host back on that show again. But this is one of our live, public, locally produced public affairs shows on KBOO. Been going for, I don't know, at least 20 to 30 years in one form or another. And you don't get too much progressive talk radio on the air anymore, ever since Air America disappeared on a national level. So this is special. This is really important. And this is the end of the year membership drive here on KBOO. We kind of need to fill out a little bit of a shortfall from our fall drive. You know, pandemic times is kind of messing with everybody's regular way of operating, including right here. So we do need to ask you for your support at this time. 80% of our funding does come from our members. We are a listener-sponsored station. If you don't know what that means, it has a long and rich and storied history going back, 7 decades, I think, to the founding of KPFA in Berkeley. We are the oldest independent community station in the country. We're a nonprofit, as I mentioned before. We don't have a corporate sponsorship. And, actually less than 10% of listeners are members of KBOO. So you can increase that ratio by going to kboo.fm/give. You can also, if you've got a mobile app on your phone, you can click on donate in that app. You can also text KBOO to 44321 on your mobile device, or you can do it the old-fashioned way by mailing to a check or money order to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You know, we don't just appreciate, we depend, as I said, on that support. That's how we keep going. This is the end of the year drive. Our on-air goal is $45,000. Well, you know why it's important to donate to KBOO, because you listen to the station and you get a lot out of it, like this program. Like having Jacqueline Keeler on, a nationally known, nationally published author and journalist, writer of books, including the last year published Standoff. Actually, maybe it was earlier this year. Anyway, it's the pandemic has just got my time sense all thrown off. You can tell us more about that if you want, but this show, which brings you a lot of really current and important issues, voices that you don't get to hear on other forms of media very often, get to hear all kinds of music genres that you don't hear too much across the dial. So those reasons and many more are reasons why we would hope you would go to kboo.fm/give or those other ways that I told you about and will continue to tell about throughout this program. So yeah, we're talking about land acknowledgments, and you're no doubt familiar with them. You may belong to an organization that gives now land acknowledgments, which is very simply is just an acknowledgement of the lands that indigenous peoples either had occupied or continue in many cases to occupy in ways that we may not even know, which is kind of another interesting thing to think about, the sort of the ways that indigenous people continue to live on the landscape that may not be acknowledged by a lot of people. And Jacqueline was, before this break, we was talking about the Willamette Falls and how the Grand Ronde had to actually buy back part of the old Blue Heron paper mill in order to get acknowledged as being the traditional holders and users from time immemorial, as they say, that land there for a very, 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 very important fishing site and cultural site, trading site, gathering site. Anyway, so yeah, you were talking about Gladstone. I think that's really interesting. It's interesting, similar to the mascot work that you've done for a long time. These flashpoints, these contentions, cultural conflicts that go on across the country in ways that sort of have these maybe just local importance, but have a resonance sometimes. And this land acknowledgement obviously is bringing up this, you know, probably become part of the cultural wars. Talk about more about that.
Yeah. So the not the land acknowledgement is not being here we have in Gladstone. It was presented by a city council member who is actually she is Cayuga. She's a tribal member from a tribe in New York State, one of the Iroquois, part of the Iroquois Confederacy, the Cayuga, one of the Six Nations, and she is the first Native city council member of Gladstone since it was founded, and she worked for 8 months with a group, a committee in Clackamas County, to develop this this land acknowledgement, right? And she was presenting it to the city council, and her name is Anissa Hartman, and she was presenting it to the city council, hoping to get it, just requesting that it be put on the November agenda to be voted on, right? It wasn't even to vote actually on the resolution approving the land acknowledgement, and it became this became this very strange topic, and they tabled it, right? And so so the next meeting in November, it wasn't on the agenda, obviously, but some folks, some members of organizations and just folks who live in the city, they gave testimony, you know, at the city council, and basically, you know, chiding the city council for not approving this, in time to basically, you know, roll it out during Native American Heritage Month, which is the month of November, and so it turned into this big fight. One of the city councilors, he actually claimed that Ripley. His last name is Ripley. He actually claimed that Randy Ripley. He claimed that he was also Native, right? But he was ashamed of this this land acknowledgement. That basically he claimed that he doesn't talk about being Native, and so he's ashamed that they feel like they need to be acknowledged in any way. And that he, not her, not Anissa Hartman, he was actually the very first Native person to be on the city council. And so we actually looked into his claims, and it turns out that he is not, he claims his mother was born on a reservation, all this stuff. His mother was born in Oklahoma, but the reservations were but she is not Native. His grandmother's first husband was Native and had a child with him, but he is not descended from that family. He is descended from her second husband, who was a white man, and so he has no Native connection at all. And so it's once again, you see this happening a lot on social media, where white people will sort of try to take on a Native identity or another ethnic or minority, racial identity, in order to sort of speak over people and to make sure that their point of view prevails, right? You see even that one woman was fired for creating a Hopi archaeologist Twitter account to try to, push sort of white supremacist ideas through a Hopi person's mouth. It's sort of, what do they call it, like sock puppetry or something, So here you have it happening in real time, and they just very you can see the YouTube video of the city council meeting, and they the mayor very abruptly cut the meeting off, and so it was a really contentious event. They part of some of the city council's concerns were that the land acknowledgement may actually lead to a sort of we give the Native the tribes the ability to sue the city for the land.
That's interesting. That thought was occurring to me as you're talking about what are the underlying fears, and so you I mean like what do they think that the land acknowledgement could actually lead to? I was like, first we acknowledge their existence, then they're going to want their land back. It's like probably part of the process, which you know, that's another interesting question, since we talk about a lot about land back. But you know, that's obviously not what this city council was actually, you know. I can't imagine she had a secret agenda to along those lines. But I think a lot of the, you know, a lot of the fears of us, of many of us colonizers, are really, I think, overblown. There's a certain paranoia based upon, I think, our, you know, basically our, you know, the guilty existence, you know, we inherently have in our relationship to the history of the U.S. But anyway, that's really interesting that actually was explicitly talked about.
Yeah, I interviewed Anessa, and I told her that, because she said that some emails went back and forth, and they claimed that they had one of the council members claimed that he had spoken to that he'd spoken to his own attorney who was a specialist in land title, and he claimed that yes, this could actually create an opening for tribes to reclaim their land, right? And it's interesting. I did look at old maps of Gladstone, which was I think named in the 1890s. It was founded fairly late, and named after the Prime Minister of Britain.
Oh yeah.
But there are large areas that where there were villages, and also where there were burial sites. When they were putting in the water main there in the 1920s, they dug up a whole bunch of remains of Native people there, and I don't know how they were handled. I just saw the reporting from the 1920s about it, and there wasn't a lot of detail on that aspect of it. So there was a village there, and there was a historic connection. I speak to David Dean Lewis about that again, and he gave me some information. But legally, as I mentioned before, because of the doctrine of discovery, tribes cannot possess title, right? Title can only be possessed by the discoverer, right? So there is actually no fear of them being able to sue in court for the land. What they can do, and what tribes have been doing, is purchasing land back, right? And then being able to attempt to take it through the Department of the Interior and get it approved to be put into trust. So a lot of reservation land and land that you see that tribes are building casinos all on are in trust. They're held in trust by the federal government. So the U.S. government has the title, but they are held in trust for the tribes by the U.S. government. His lawyer didn't know very much about Indian federal law. Many lawyers do not. I think I mentioned before in the show how even Supreme Court justices don't know Indian federal law very well. It's sort of not taught, and it's not required to pass the bar. So I think Sotomayor said that she didn't know anything about Indian federal law until she got to the Supreme Court, right? I think Gorsuch is the first one that actually has any knowledge of it. And he's the one that was decisive in ruling in favor of the non-disestablishment of reservations in Oklahoma, which basically acknowledged the five civilized tribes in Oklahoma, still the reservations were never disestablished, although they no longer own the land title has passed to non-natives. But which is where the big fight's happening right now about the state killing death row inmates on what is now the Muskogee reservation. So whether they have the state has the right to do that anymore, because tribes have sovereignty over that area, that part of the state now. So yeah, it has all kinds of permutations. But if the tribes were able to purchase the land and then to put it into trust, then they would have jurisdiction as well. So So they didn't understand the issue at all, and this drove them to this sort of thing.
So we're this is KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio, and this is the second Wednesday program with my second Wednesday co-host Jacqueline Keeler, and we're talking about land acknowledgments. Are they enough? How do we decolonize? I just kind of threw that out, but maybe we could talk about that. What are the actual steps? What are the responsibilities beyond land acknowledgement of the many, many, many increasing number of organizations and institutions, including KBOO, that are giving land acknowledgements? I'd like to talk for a minute about what your responsibilities as a listener are or might be. Really depends on you, how you feel about that. We can't compel you. We can't turn off your radio if you don't support us. This is a free service, freely offered service. It's been going on for more than half a century, and we hope to keep that going for quite a while longer. And as you know, we are, well, if you're a regular listener, you know that we are increasingly important in these pandemic times. 52 years old, I always get that wrong. We're going on 53. We're one of the oldest media institutions in Portland. As I said, we're listener sponsored. We're a nonprofit. We depend on your support. 80% of our support, financial support, does come from our members. Our members and other contributors, you don't have to become a member. $40, I think, is the baseline. $60 is a regular, for a year, is a regular membership that allows you to become a full member in good standing of KBOO. You can vote in our board of directors elections. You get more regular notices of what's going on at the station and all that. But as I said before, less than 10% of listeners are actually members of KBOO. So we'd like to, if we could increase that and have people give regularly, we wouldn't have to come at you to ask you for your support. So please go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button that is so handily right there, or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, where I'm sitting right now in Portland, Oregon, 97214. And that's about all I've got to say. We've trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. A little more difficult now, everything's kind of on automatic here. Everything mostly by remote. There's a few of us who are able to come in and do our shows in person, which I thank the management for. And I also thank the management for being able to keep this station going through what's going on 2 years of this pandemic. Anyway, I've been doing the show with Jacqueline Keeler for, 5 or 6, 7 years now. And I personally get a lot out of it. And I if you do, who are listening, if you get a lot out of the really different perspective that Jacqueline provides, please support our programming, all of our programming here at KBOO. Okay, well, back to our regularly scheduled program, talking about land acknowledgements. Well, let me just throw this is really interesting that getting these insights into what's going on in places like Gladstone, which is, right on the southern border of Portland, heading towards what we had talked about last month, Willamette Falls in Oregon City. These are, everywhere has rich indigenous history. And, I think that's just, start with that. It's kind of just the starting point, even in acknowledgement, just the names. But people don't even, people don't know where, the village sites were, where the burial sites, as you mentioned, that so often through history just have gotten buried up and not even properly handled. and just sort of cast aside. Now, of course, through the advocacy of Native Americans, there is actually laws that protect those burials, but so much of that has just been built upon and we don't even know anything about it.
Yeah, and I think often tribes sort of don't sort of keep private the knowledge of where these sites are because they become looted, right? And certainly at Standing Rock, we saw an extreme example where the tribes filed an injunction to try to stop the building of the pipeline, and they identified in the injunction where different sort of archaeological sites were. And the very next day, the oil company basically set a whole bunch of bulldozers and stuff over there and destroyed them so that they would not be an issue in building the pipeline. Yeah. So, but yeah, we are getting some response on Twitter from folks about land acknowledgement. I sort of put the question out there when I shared the link to the show. And we got one from Karina Gould, who is actually, she's Ohlone from the Bay Area. She's a tribal leader there. She's the representative of the Confederated Villages of Lausanne Ohlone, in what is now San Francisco or Oakland. And she writes, land acknowledgments must always come from real action items. They must be a living document that changes as goals are met. They should be about building relationships with the Native people on whose land they are on. I'm going to actually retweet that. But yeah, it's and I should also note from the at the Gladstone meeting on November 9th, North Clackamas School Board member Kathy Y. read a statement on behalf of the Oregon School Board Members of Color Caucus. She writes, she said, land acknowledgments are the first step and certainly not the last in healing the generational trauma placed upon Indigenous people. For Gladstone City Council to begin healing, it would be a step in the right direction for non-Natives to take initiative and include land acknowledgments in their daily work.
So, let me just break in real quick, because I was going to give the number to call in. We haven't had a caller, possibly because I haven't said that the number is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. We have a couple lines open, and we're less than 20 minutes to go. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, no, fine. Yeah, please do call in. I'd love to hear what people think about land acknowledgments, how they feel when they hear them. Do they feel like it's performative, or do they feel like, wow, I didn't know that before? Does it make them want to learn more about the tribes that were there before? And so I would love to hear people's thoughts on that. But another Native person who tweeted at me, he's actually a Choctaw tribal member and author and fellow Dartmouth graduate who lives in England. And he actually successfully got the Exeter Chiefs, the rugby team there, to change their mascot, which happened in the past week. He writes, for me, I cringe, to be honest. I mean, yes, as you know, about land acknowledgments. Yes, of course, those doing the acknowledgement are on a given nation's land, but what are they going to do about it? I get that we have to start somewhere, but words without action are easy and kind of meaningless. So a lot of folks are talking about action that can be taken. And so I think what you see happening with the Grand Ronde tribes purchasing of the paper mill has actually allowed them to, in Oregon City, has allowed them to basically take control of what the Riverwalk will look like and the tens of millions of dollars that's been garnered to do it, to build it. So they basically have thrown out the designs that the city and the partnership had put together, city, metro, and state and county, and they have created their own. And this one is very different. It doesn't focus on the history, simply on the industrial history. You know, Oregon City at the falls there was the first place that a long distance electric transmission occurred in the entire world. They sent electricity from the falls to Portland, and that was the first time that had ever been done. So they focus more on that sort of industrial history and not so much on the indigenous history. So when the tribe redrew the plans for the Riverwalk, they actually tore down a lot of those buildings, and they're actually focusing more on restoring Salmon Run, the area to what it was before, and also include an area for the tribe to be able to do ceremonies and to reconnect with the falls themselves. And so so it's just, you see, the perspective is very different. And when the tribe is involved and when the tribe has some say.
So let me just throw that question back again. I mean, Kebu, we talk about all kinds of issues. We have two specifically Native-focused shows on Thursday evening at 6 and at Monday morning at 11, if I'm not mistaken. And then we have this monthly show with you. So I guess three shows. Reporting on Democracy Now! And other shows, and Dennis Bernstein talks a lot with the Native folks and on Indigenous issues. What more could, Kebu, for example, do? Or is that kind of, I might be putting you on the spot a little bit. I know, maybe in the context of, maybe not land back. I mean, I don't know, the idea of giving this small building here in Southeast back to Native nations might be a noble gesture, but I'm not sure what it would actually accomplish. But, there's nearby, there's that land back, that arts foundation that gave that land, the building back to a Native arts group. I don't know, it's kind of a big question, but again, what is the responsibility of all kinds of different groups who use land acknowledgements to perhaps take a further step?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I actually was asked by the Native Arts and Culture Fund to write about the land back gesture, or the building that was transferred to them from the Yale Union Building in Portland, and that was done in February 2021. So, and I really look forward to events that we'll be having there soon, which gives Native artists and a space here in the city to be able to to be part of the community, and I think that's something that's really missing. I think I lived for a few years when I first graduated from college and was first married. I lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and did a lot of work with the tribes there, and also in Santa Fe. I actually lobbied for tribes at the state legislature, and I have to say I really miss seeing in New Mexico, tribes are so present. They're everywhere. You can't deny the existence of modern Native people. Even if you don't see them in TV shows, like what's that show that was there?
Reservation Dogs.
No, the one that was based in Albuquerque. The meth guy. What's the name of that show? I can't remember. But anyway, if you actually live in Albuquerque, Native people are everywhere. And I remember being in a Borders bookstore there, and like everyone in there was Native, was a Native person, right? It's just, you don't get that anywhere else in the country. And I think that having Native people, what they bring to the community, what they bring to with their art, of course the art is really visible, hyper visible in Santa Fe and New Mexico in general. And I think but you don't have, sort of this living culture that's evolving, that has so much to give after 10,000 years. It's it adds something to the community, and that's missing if you don't, if it's just, there's no space for it, there's no actual space. And so, yeah, I think maybe space is important. The Native Arts and Culture Fund, what they received, they were actually based in Vancouver, Washington, with very minimal offices, and mostly focused on giving, raising money to give to Native artists. Native artists Native people get a very small part of the nonprofit donor dollars. I think much smaller than our percentage of the population. And but this gift from the Yale Union Building, a $5 million building that was entirely paid for and renovated, was really really amazing, and I can't wait to see it actually become really activated in the community. So as far as what Kebu can do to sort of really do something active the land back. I haven't really thought about it. I'd be interested to hear what people think, you know, would be something that the Kibu could do.
Maybe we could make this sort of a call out to the general Kibu community to have a discussion on this question.
Yeah. That would be really, I think for myself, maybe I've been meaning to do more with the studio. I definitely would be interested in doing more and actually doing my own show. I know I've not, I guess I would have to think about that a bit and talk to more people what they think the community wants.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, we do have our first caller. That's Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I've got an idea of what we can do. I remember several years ago, Kibu helped Pikun organize their radio station, which I believe is still working. I remember going on walks to raise money, and I remember Kibu having a fund drive over the air to raise money for them, and they got started. So why couldn't we do something to encourage the tribes to set up their own local radio station that they control, they set the agenda for, and it promotes the various cultures? I don't see why some of the smaller tribes might even be willing to join into like a collaborative effort and do something like that. I don't know if maybe the tribes have done something like this already, but I'm not aware of it.
Warm Springs has KWSO. I know that for a fact. They've been going on strong for a while. You can hear them, you know, once you get over on the other side of Mount Hood. Can't hear them too much here. I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe somebody has. I don't think Yakima has a station. I don't think Umatilla, but I could be wrong about this. That's a good question. But as far as more locally, I know we have a translator out in, you know, the heart of the river native community out there in White Salmon. You know, who knows? Maybe we could, you know, morph that into something.
The problem with the translator is that's controlled by Kibu, which is not native. I mean, there are some.
No. I'm saying maybe that could morph into something. I don't know. I'm just sort of going along with your sort of throwing ideas out there. That's something I've kind of thought. But no, thank you, Tim. I think that's a brilliant idea to put into the mix. What do you think, Jackie?
I think it's a great idea, and I like to focus on it being controlled by the tribe or by Native people, because often when we're just an add-on, one of the issues that I saw with the issue of land acknowledgments is that asking what corporations like Microsoft can do, really, you know, is it for decades now? I mean, you know, they've been attempting to do these sort of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And yet they are not having the effect that they hoped they had. I remember, you know, in the 1990s, there was a very large journalism conference nationally held called Unity. And if you look at the stats now, you know, some 20 years later, nothing's changed. The representation has actually gotten worse with minorities in journalism, right? And it's gone down, not gone up. So these initiatives often don't lead anywhere, whether it's trying to employ more engineers at Microsoft of color or even women. We haven't seen any change. And I think this is because the issue is structural, right? And the structural change has to be a change in the power dynamics themselves. And as I've mentioned before, I think we need actually a federal indigenous government, because that would make the political reality of Native Nations far more real. And as in the case you see in Oklahoma, where suddenly the state is finding out that all these reservations have not been disestablished, right? And suddenly they have to contend with the political jurisdiction of the tribes in a much more real way, and they might not be able to execute prisoners anymore. I mean, so it's ways in which when the tribes become politically real, it's much harder to argue with them and much harder to dismiss them. And I think this is where we need to go. Land back is good in that it lets people know that Native people existed and their names, right, the names of the tribes. But we need actual change in the power structure itself. And everything else will sort of cascade from that.
Well, Tim, did you want to say one more thing before we let you go?
Well, Jacqueline kind of blew me away there.
Okay.
No, I just think that that's one good idea. I don't know, maybe some sort of confederation at a level of social change, art, music, and strengthening of the tribes, like to work together, not to be one nation necessarily, but could be.
Of course, that'll obviously come from the Native nations and peoples themselves, obviously.
Right.
But we got only a couple minutes left, so we got to let you go, Tim.
All right. You take care.
Yeah, you take care yourself. I think that idea of, you're talking about these initiatives within, like, corporate America. I mean, my thought is, well, why don't they, use some of their, especially the ones that are really profitable, what they use, Microsoft certainly is, use some of their profits to actually fund, real initiatives that are native, native, like a radio station or like whatever, or like buying back some, buying some land and giving the title to whatever, maybe instead of buying more and more for their campuses, whether it's Nike or Microsoft or whatever, they just keep gobbling up land themselves. Maybe actually, giving back directly. I don't know. But yeah, what do you think about land acknowledgements? What do you think about these bigger questions? We have I have a website, a Facebook page, KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. My co-host Jacqueline Keeler has probably some places. Where could people reach you?
Oh yeah, I'm on Twitter right now, and we're actually having a discussion on Twitter about land acknowledgement. My Twitter handle is @JFKeeler. And you can find me on Facebook at Jacqueline Keeler. I have a professional page and a personal page, and then on Instagram at JF Keeler. And so I think definitely call in and let us know what you think. I think only by discussing this and kind of envisioning it can we really begin to make it real. To make change. One of the aspects, I think, when I was doing research on land acknowledgement, was that they really, different organizations that promote land acknowledgements, they really suggest that it be a collaborative action, that for the city not just kind of look one up online and use it, but that they actually work together to create it. And maybe this was probably the issue with the city of Gladstone, that the city council members were not part of the process of creating it. It was created by the Clackamas Caucus and people of color. And so they were not aware of how and why it was created. And but at the same time, I can't help but think that they might have stymied the progress of creating it. And many of the council members seemed very opposed to the idea of land acknowledgement.
Well, Jacqueline, we've actually got to go because I got to remind people of our end of the year drive one more time.
Sure.
So I'll just thank you for being on our second Wednesday. You can hear Jacqueline Keeler every second Wednesday here on Wednesday Talk Radio at 8 a.m. Thanks a lot, Jackie. Good talking with you again. So as I said, go to kboo.fm/give. We are a listener-sponsored, membership-driven community radio station, and that's how we survive. That's how we keep everything going, the lights on, the mics on, all that, our equipment maintained by our engineering department. So kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44321. If you got a mobile app, you can click donate there, or you can mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. But however you do it, don't delay. Do it right now and help us reach our goal of $45,000 for this special added end of the year drive, which we need to give us energy going into the new year, 2022. It's going to be a good one. It's got to be better than this one. I tell you, trials and tribulations we are going through, and KBOO is right here with you all the way, 24/7. And that's what it means to be a community institution like KBOO. Well, I'm Paul Rowland. I am your regular host here on Wednesday Talk Radio. It's been great being with you. I'll be with you again next week. Thanks, Ty, for operating the board. Thanks to everyone for listening. Sorry we didn't get more callers, but we'll be back here next week. Bye, everybody.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now and you will see we're only...
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
The indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala, bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya.